Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
A rare condition known as congenital analgesia sounds like it would make life better. People born with this don't feel the sting of vaccination shots, the throb of a sprained ankle or a bump on the head. In fact, they don't feel any pain at all. But it's actually a real problem. Think of the risk of burns if you didn't realize a pot handle was sizzling hot, or how badly ill-fitting shoes could damage the skin on your ankle if you couldn't feel the agony of a blister. Physical pain is awful, but it exists to signal that some part of our body needs attention or care. Actually, the same thing is true for emotional pain. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing is, we dread painful emotional states so much that we've come to pathologize nearly all bad feelings, assuming they are telling us we are mentally unwell, rather than paying attention to what else they might be telling us. It's true, some people need help to function in the face of anxiety, depression, even prolonged grief. But that doesn't mean those feelings are always wrong. Mariana Alessandri is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and co-founder of the nonprofit RGV Puede. Her book is called Night Vision, Seeing Ourselves Through Dark Moods. Mariana, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You note that we can have this urge as a society to pair good with light and bad with dark. So if you'll pardon the pun, that can literally blind us to possibilities for growth and learning that can come from dark moods and emotions?
Yeah, I think that we're kind of suffering from a society that is putting just too much light on us and expecting us to be too light, and we need some shade.
This is not a new phenomenon, right? It starts with Plato, of all people.
Yeah, no, in the book, I talk about the cave. It's such a beautiful story and metaphor that the idea was that we're all prisoners in a cave, and we're supposed to be able to get out. And so one prisoner, we have chains on our necks and on our hands and on our feet. And one guy gets like liberated, and he gets made to turn around, and he first sees the fire. And then he gets sort of blinded by that. And then he gets dragged out of the cave and then into the sun. And the idea is that everything he was seeing on the inside of the cave, all these shadows, he was reading the walls of his cave and thinking that trees were actually just shadows. When he gets out, he gets blinded at first, but then the lesson is supposed to be that he sees the light and he learns what a real tree is, and then he rejects everything that he learned inside of the cave as false, and then he wants to go save his friends, but Plato says that we would just kill him if he came back in to try to save us because he's blind. But since then, and you know, maybe before then, and not just philosophy, but other disciplines have added to the idea that light is better than dark, that to be enlightened is to be intelligent, and that to be dark is ignorant. And when that comes into especially the realm of the emotions, what are we going to do? Because we're certainly not creatures of all bright and sunny emotions. And so then we end up hating our darkness, hating the parts of us that are not bright and sunny, and feeling guilty and feeling ashamed of them.
And Enlightenment philosophers, by the way, not only doubled down on what Plato thought, but added a troubling component of racism to that same mix.
Yeah, no, it's really problematic. If everything bright and light is right and good and intelligent and holy and safe, right, then everything dark is dangerous and ugly and ignorant. And of course, when you apply that to bodies and skin, that has had so many ramifications. And so I'm trying to question the metaphor for everything, right, for race, but also mostly for emotions. But I'm trying to sort of draw attention to the fact that it also has these terrible racial connotations, and we need to stop talking in these black and white ways, these light and dark ways.
So later, after the Enlightenment philosophers, came the existentialists, who were completely open to the idea that life can be really hard. Why did that way of thinking not persist widely into modern times?
I mean, it's fascinating because it really had a heyday, right? If you ask middle-aged men, especially when I meet them, they say, "Oh, I read all those existentialists. I love the existentialists, 60s, 70s, a bit of the 80s." And now there's very few people who sort of identify with existentialism, but and it's the way that a lot of people get into philosophy, but then they say they outgrow it. And I thought, "Oh, I never outgrew existentialism because I still think life is hard. I think life is brutal. I think that human beings are the kinds of people who hold your hair while you vomit and hold your hand while you die. We suffer and we bleed, and the people that we love suffer and bleed. And that's what the existentialists are willing to go there. They're willing to talk about it. They're willing to talk about dark moods and sadness and pain. And so I just find so much solace in them. I find them to give me the shade I need from a world that is very much influenced by ancient philosophy, which is very bright-sided, mixed with this kind of power of positive thinking from the 1950s, especially in the US, which gives us a recipe for disaster, because what that leads to is signs that say, "Choose happy." Like, if you've seen that sign around your place, like around your world, then it says that you believe that you can choose your mood, one, and that's a very stoic idea, that we get to choose to be happy. Seneca says, change your attitude, not your surroundings. Right? So we have the power. My students love it. I love stoicism too, but it's quite problematic, because what it means is you get to, your house could be totally on fire, falling down, and you can remain tranquil, as they say. This is their word, tranquility, or ataraxia, like freedom from worry. And you get to choose happy. But then, because of Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking in the US, we also translate that into you can also manifest your dreams, and you can somehow build another dream house when your house burns down. And so we have these crazy expectations that we see all over, not just on Instagram, but also on Instagram, where everyone else seems to be living this amazing, happy life, and they manifested their dreams, and you can too, and you can beat your darkness, and you can overcome your negativity. And so I just think, wow, I got to get out of this world. Like, I can't live in this world. So I wrote a book to try to make a new world for those of us who feel just bombarded by the light and need a place to take cover and need a place to, like, just have some shade, be really human with our pain and be vulnerable and just commune with each other and recognize that there's a lot of beauty in the darkness as well.
You're talking about this now, and you're very candid in the book that you often feel emotionally dark. Did you sense that as a flaw until you started digging into this and trying to think differently about what those moods might mean in your life?
Yeah, so I feel dark every day. Anger is the one that I like to use because I'm sort of dispositionally angry. And so I'm angry all the time. And I always felt, and I have little kids, and so it means that I'm often angry at them. And I just assumed that it's because I'm kind of uncouth, right? I'm a monster. Who yells at little kids, you know? And so during the quarantine, when I was writing this book, I had the fortune of experiencing all the moods that I was writing as I was writing them. So as I'm trying to write about anger, I'm yelling at my kids. I tell a story in the book where I like throw almonds at them because they couldn't decide who was getting more. They were fighting about it. And then I go to my room and I look in the mirror and I just see a monster, right? I'm like, what kind of a terrible mother am I that I get angry and I yell at my kids and all I want to do is be sweet and loving and wonderful? Why can't I be better? And so then the Stoics say, yeah, you should be better because you should apologize for even getting angry. So if you've ever said something like, "I'm sorry I got angry," that's Stoic, because the philosophy behind that is that you can actually stop that from happening with practice. Now, it's very hard to practice Stoicism, but with practice, you should be able to control your feelings. And then, I was like, oh, that's really hard. Like, I tried it for, a year or so. And then I tried Aristotle, and Aristotle was much nicer to me. And he says, you can get angry. It's okay to feel something, but don't act on it. So if you say something like, "I'm sorry I yelled at you out of anger," it's okay that I was angry, but I shouldn't have yelled at you. So he focuses more on our behavior. And so, but during the quarantine, it was all overloading. So I was just like, no, even Aristotle's too hard for me. I can't do this. I'm just going to either live feeling like a monster for the rest of my life, or I need some new philosophers. I need to get re-educated on what anger is and how I can feel about my anger so that I don't have to walk around feeling just like a fundamentally flawed human being, that something's just fundamentally wrong with me.
How did Audre Lorde push back on assumptions that women and people of color who become angry are irrational or somehow to be feared? How did she learn to use her own anger?
Yeah, Audre Lorde's amazing. So that if, especially for women, it's so easy to get a woman to feel ashamed of anger because it's unladylike. And so the three things that I felt like kept repeating in my head were you're crazy, you're irrational, and you're ugly, right? Those are the things that women, you know, some women feel when we're angry. Like that's the feeling we're not supposed to feel. And Audre Lorde says, wait a second. Your anger is information. Your anger is a tool with which to excavate honesty. Your anger, she says, every woman has an arsenal of anger waiting for us to tap into it. So instead of just discounting it off the bat as saying, if it's anger, then it's bad, like the Stoics would have us say, she says, if it's anger, then it's information. If it's anger, then listen to it. And I feel like in 2023, we're finally ready to hear Audre Lorde, because there's a lot of people, I feel like of all the moods in the book, anger's already, it's got like a leg up on the other ones. People are starting to, they're already like, it's out there that anger can be good. It's not necessarily always good. That's not what I'm saying, but it shouldn't be just rejected as bad. So Audre Lorde is huge in terms of getting us to think of it just neutral, right? Let's just listen to it. It's not something scary. It's telling me something's wrong. So I would like to go from thinking something's wrong with me to something's wrong. If we could stop there and then investigate. So I did this, right, with myself in my room, instead of just going with, you know, Seneca and saying I'm a monster. I said, okay, let me go with Audre Lorde. What's wrong? Oh, I'm taking on too many things. Me and every other woman during the pandemic. Oh, I'm taking on too many. I'm doing too much. And some of it was just things that I thought I could handle, but that were too much, right? So you start realizing that it's not me who's broken. It's the world that's broken. It's systems that are broken. And so then I started releasing the feeling that I was a monster and saying, no, I'm actually just a human being whose body is trying to tell me that there's too much and I need relief from all of the pressure that's on top of me.
Yeah, it is so interesting in this book for you to include like Epictetus and Audre Lorde. I mean, Epictetus would say, well, the trouble starts with like, what did you expect? The world is terrible. Don't expect things to be better and then you won't get angry about it. And Audre Lorde says you can't change any of that unless you get angry about it.
That's the fundamental difference. That's what I wish that people would understand. Like the Stoics were writing in a world that they could not change. Right. So if you take as your presumption, and this is a lot of self-help actually today, takes as its premise, like hidden premise, that you actually can't change your surroundings. You can't change the world. No one's going to change the people are the way they are. That's it. And so you can only change yourself. And so what Epictetus says is it's not the things that happen to you that bother you. It's your judgments about the things. Right. So you are the problem. You're the one who's making it worse. Things happen and we ought to be more neutral about them. If we can stop thinking that they're bad things that are happening, but just say, he says, you know, just say your house burned down. Don't say your house burned down and it's terrible. So, but he's taking for granted that it's a world that doesn't change. And I think for good reason in their age. But today, like I have a bizarre, like, I don't know if it's faith in people. Like, I actually think we can change the world. I think that if we're, yeah, mad enough, upset enough, questioning enough, philosophical enough, I actually believe in the power of philosophy to change people's minds and to open their eyes to something new so that we can treat each other differently, we can treat ourselves differently, and we can lower the expectations around us to always stay sunny, because that's just not happening. And the pressure to be sunny is actually probably what makes things worse for us. Things are already bad, pain already happens, but then the pressure of society for me to keep a gratitude journal just then makes me feel 10 times worse about myself when I fail to be grateful.
Mariana, you note that we have reached epidemic levels of anxiety and depression, especially among teenagers. My recollection of being a teenager back in the 80s was that it was sort of understood to be a time when our kind of dawning awareness of the world would cause us a great deal of stress. It was normal to be upset about these things. We might well have missed some cases of clinical mental illness, and that's a problem. But we also, I think, avoided taking on these labels that might shape how we thought about our moods for the rest of our lives.
I mean, so I'm particularly concerned with college students because I'm a college teacher, right? So I've got students who come in and they say, they come into my office and say, I have social anxiety, and it's kind of hush hush. And then, little by little by little, they recognize that everyone in the class has some sort of anxiety, right? Like it's the number one mental illness among college students. And so the first step is to recognize, and this is what destigmatization is good at. It's good at saying, hey, you're not the only one, right? We're all in the same boat. There's like plenty of people who are anxious. But the problem for me with that kind of messaging and the limitation of destigmatization is that it does not confer dignity on the human being. It does not recognize the dignity of an anxious person. And so what it says, like the secret half, the back half of the sentence, we're all in the same boat, is to say we're all broken. We all have broken brains. And this is the sort of thing that my students, that's the way they describe anxiety. And so I thought, okay, I also, have anxiety. I don't know what level, but I have experienced it and I have it quite often. And so I was thinking, again, I want to think of myself not just as like a flawed, like a broken human being. Who can help me? And I love Soren Kierkegaard, I always have. And he just comes out with this life-changing way of thinking about anxiety. And he basically considers it a kind of intelligence. He says the anxious people are higher than the animals and angels. And he says, and if you're not anxious, he says, let's worry more about people who aren't anxious. Because if you could just imagine like a really dopey person who has no real insides, no connection to a world that's bleeding, who just sort of walks around like doo-doo-doo, right? Like that's a person with, is that who we want to be? I don't think so, right? So he says the more like attuned you are, the more intelligent you are. He says, even about a whole civilization, he says, the more anxious the civilization is, the more profound the civilization is. And so when people start worrying about kids because they're anxious, I think the other way, I think who's not anxious? It's people who are maybe not, in Glennon Doyle's words, paying attention, right? Like we have reasons to be anxious. If you open your phone, it will give you 10 reasons before you even wake up fully to be anxious. And so I think people who are anxious are really tuned in and they're quite sensitive to the world. And whereas before, I think the messaging was like, toughen up, get over it, don't be a snowflake, you have to get a thick skin. I think the world is definitely opening up to the realm of that these dark moods make us sensitive, and the sensitivity is not something that we're trying to overcome. It's something to tap into. Like I think that the sensitive among us are the precious among us because they can really like show us how to connect with each other. They can show us how to be human. They can show us how to exist and how to be vulnerable. And so the idea of like there was a, overcome anxiety, right? Like overcome anxiety or eliminate negative thinking. Kierkegaard would just laugh at that, A, because no, of course not. Anxiety is a part of being human. And there's also this good part of it, which we never, never, never talk about. So in the book, I talk about how my son, kind of, he used to, when he was little, maybe 7, he said, I love almost being late. And I said, why do you love almost being late? And he said, I just love the running around. I love the, get in the car and you're almost late. And I said, oh, you know what? That's anxiety. We don't think of it as anxiety. We don't think there's anything good about it because the world does not say anything. Like, think about all of the words that we use to describe all these. They're all disorder, dysfunction, distorted thinking, mental illness. Like, we do not have one nice thing to say about the dark moods I'm talking about. And so I'm trying to give us nicer language. And when I give talks about the book, when I talk to students about it, and they say, whoa, I never knew that I was intelligent. Like, this is really nice. It's nice to think of myself not as broken, but actually, I have something to contribute to the world because I'm tuned in a way that maybe other people aren't.
I imagine this is already clear to people listening, but I'll note here, this book is not designed to make us all thankful for our dark moods. They feel awful and will continue to feel awful. It is a call to at least recognize why we have those moods and what they're meant to do for us. How do we start listening to bad feelings and trying to plumb some greater meaning from them?
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And one formulation that I've thought about is that I'm not even trying to dignify the mood. Like, I'm not saying this is not the five gifts of your depression, right? I am trying to dignify the human. And I'm saying, even if you are on the floor in your bathroom in a horrible depression, you are dignified. And I don't think anyone thinks like that, right? I don't think people are going around saying that. It's all kind of brokenness, it's chemical imbalance, it's just fundamental flaws. And so I think the mental illness language is much better than the laziness language. Like, I think we've come far in not thinking that, for instance, depressed people are lazy or just selfish or something like that. At least now I think it's better because it doesn't feel so much like blame. But it does feel still to me like there's nothing that could make the person feel, dignified. And so I'm not trying to say this mood is good for you. I use Gloria Anzaldúa in the chapter on depression because she makes a metaphor out of her depression. She was writing her book around 1987, which was when Prozac came out. And so she didn't really use like clinical depression. She didn't really use that term very much in her correspondence. And she just called it the Coatlicue state. And this is comes from Aztec philosophy. And that Coatlicue is the mother goddess, and she's got snakes for heads, and she's made of stone. And Anzaldúa said, I hate it. I hate every minute of it. I go into this state and for weeks, and I don't wash my dishes, and I don't answer my phone, and it's the worst. And also, she doesn't want to just turn on herself and say, that's why I'm broken. She makes it part of her, she calls it seven stages of conocimiento, which is part like conocimiento is like a deep knowing. And she says, that's stage three. And I go through that. And then out of it, I can write about it and I can make art and I can do all sorts of things. Right. And she's also not prescribing it for us, but she is trying to, or I think what I'm getting out of her is that she can give us different ways to talk about it. Not that we're all going to go around using the word Coatlicue state, but that if we could use other metaphors in addition to mental illness, we don't have to, reject mental illness language, but other metaphors might make us feel more dignified than just saying, I'm broken.
There's also this idea, it's not quite the same thing as blaming people for what we characterize as mental illness, but if we call something mental illness and there is treatment available and people don't respond to treatment or they don't want treatment, we may not blame them, but we clearly think they're making the wrong decision in our culture.
Yeah, I mean, the medicine is the trickiest part of the whole book, I think. And I do not want to be taken as like anti-medical or anti-psychiatry or anything, because there was a book in the 80s called Plato, Not Prozac. And I don't, so it obviously the premise is like, we don't need medicine, we just need philosophy, And I think my book could be retitled Plato and Prozac. I don't think there has to be a conflict between a Western way of seeing it or even a philosophical way and other ways, right? Like this existential way that I'm trying to sort of bring into the conversation. All I want to do is add more vocabulary to the ways that we talk about these moods so that we can sort of flood our world with more than just choose happy. Because the whole result of choose happy, this is like the whole premise of self-help, the whole premise of stoicism, is it's going great and you're riding a high when you're happy and you say, I chose happy. And then as soon as you're sad, as soon as you're down, as soon as you're really, really, really in the dumps, you're going to say to yourself, there's no other conclusion to draw than I did not choose happy. And so that's what I'm more concerned about than whether we take medication or don't take medication, right? I think that medication really helps a lot of people. And in the anxiety chapter, I talk about it as trying to use the medication to lower the voice, lower the volume of the voices in your head, right? Like if you're unable to concentrate on anything else, I think medication can work great. And then once you get them to a manageable level, then listen to them, right? The idea is not to get rid of them because that would be getting rid of valuable information. So there's a lot of tricky stuff in here, but it's not the gifts of your depression or the gift of your anxiety, and it's also not anti-psychiatry. It's to say they are part of us, and certainly my students sort of want to just trash that part of them. And I say, well, the bad news is that if you trash that part of yourself, you're trashing yourself. Right. So what are we going to do? We can't get rid of these things. There is no getting rid of them. So how do we learn to live alongside them? Like even just the language we use, like I try to be careful with language, like, I suffer from versus I live with, right? I live with anxiety versus I suffer from, right? So there's ways I think that we can talk both about our own moods, but also mostly I just want to change society. I want to change the way society talks about our moods. I want to stop seeing t-shirts that say stay positive. I want to stop seeing t-shirts like my kids soccer coach wears a t-shirt that says hashtag no bad days. And when I see that, I've already lost. I think, oh, it's over for me, right? Because I had a bad day. Like the expectation is so unrealistic. And I think a lot of us are feeling this. And it's like, we need shade. Like it's too sunny out. We need a place, we need a tree to sit under, because the no bad days is ridiculous. We are human beings and we suffer. And that's not wrong. We're not bad. We're not, you know, fundamentally flawed human beings.
Mariana, can philosophy give us insight into our obligation to other people when we are experiencing dark moods, when we are experiencing anger or even sadness or what might be called depression? That can affect people around us. On the other hand, people around us may be the most inclined to tell us our emotions have no value.
Yes. So when I was teaching the research that I did for this book this past semester, and when we got to the grief part, my students just realized like how much we as a society tend to make worse people's grief. And so we read a chapter from Megan Devine's It's Okay That You're Not Okay. I think it's called Understanding Grief in a World That Doesn't Understand, something like this. And it really is like, wow, we make people feel so much worse because they already feel bad if they've lost someone. And then we say the craziest things to them. So think about anything that has ever been said to you when you're sad. Think about if you've ever said anything to someone when they're grieving, when they've lost something. We want to, and we've been taught, it's not our fault. We've been taught that if someone's down, you're supposed to bring them up. We feel responsible for cheering people up. And so this author, Megan Devine, she says it was like a week after her partner drowned, people were like, you know what? You really need to go dancing. Let's go dancing. And just on and on and on and on. And I tie that back to Epicureans, who give us the idea that happy and sad are opposites. And if you're sad, you're not happy. And we don't like to see people sad, especially our loved ones. And so we wipe away their tears and we want them to feel happy. So that's for me what's wrong. And I have an example from my own mom, who she had 9 kids. She lost my brother when he was 9 years old. And could you imagine the sorts of things that they said to her? She said that the worst thing that they said to her was, well, at least you have all those other kids.
Wow.
And she's like, oh my goodness. Like of all the things, right? People are so well-intentioned. All they want to do is say something nice, but they end up like sticking a knife in your heart because they inadvertently make you feel worse. And so a lot of it is just trying to show us how we do sometimes make it worse by putting our foot in our mouth. Or what happens to grievers a lot is that people just leave them because they say, well, I didn't know what to say to that person, so I didn't respond at all, right? And then the griever feels all alone. So if you're asking about philosophy, yes, I think like Miguel de Unamuno is my hero from chapter 2 on sadness and dolor and pain, emotional pain. And he says that we connect better when we're sad. This is his experience and this is his belief. And you can decide whether you think that's true or not. But he says that when bodies connect in pleasure, and he means exactly what you think he means. And he says, but souls connect in pain. And he and his wife also lost their baby when the baby was 6 years old. And he says, we were crushed in the same mortar under the same pestle. And that they connected in a way that they had never connected. And he said, that's what's possible when you suffer with someone else. So instead of leaving someone alone, that you would actually go near them and talk to them. And he gives us this beautiful image of string instruments, which if one, like I think of guitars, if one guitar is near another one and one guitar, someone plucks the strings, the other strings start vibrating also. And he says, that's how our heartstrings are, that when I feel pain, your heartstring should vibrate. And then someone asked him, but you know, what happens when that doesn't happen? Why does it go wrong? Why do we sometimes feel numb to someone else's pain? And he says, well, either the other person doesn't have heartstrings or their heartstrings have been frozen. So I think a lot of us, because we're so uncomfortable, we're pretty inept at dealing with our loved one's pain because we just want everyone to be okay all the time. We don't resonate with them and we don't go there with them. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross tells this amazing story that I included in the book of parents who are talking to their daughter. The daughter had just lost her husband. And so the daughter starts crying on the phone And the mother says, okay, I'll let you go. Because that's a very like normal reaction. Like people cry in private, I'll let you go. You go be, you know, by yourself. And the dad said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm gonna stay right here and you cry as much as you want. And it's like, that's what I think philosophy can give us. It can give us a different way of showing up for each other and not feeling like we're responsible for cheering each other up. But if we love each other, we are responsible for being with each other and not leaving each other just completely alone. It's okay to let someone be sad. It's okay to be sad with them. So if we could stop being so nyctophobic or afraid of the dark, afraid of our own darkness, other people's darkness, I think that we could treat each other more lovingly and we could resonate with them and they with us.
Mariana Alessandri is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, co-founder of the nonprofit RGV Puede. Her book is called Night Vision, Seeing Ourselves Through Dark Moods. Mariana, thank you so much for making time to talk today.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.